One, two, three, four, five. Interview with Mr. Toon Farrell on the F1 engine. And I wanted to start out if you could tell me your background with the engine program and when you came to Marshall and that kind
of stuff. I came here in July 1963 mm-hmm. and worked on the J2 engine exclusively up until about 2 years ago, mm-hmm. where I had responsibility of the three engines,
yeah.
F1, J2, and H1.
Right. There's a specific question about the F1 I wanted to ask before we get on too far, and that's in the thrust chamber extension skirt. Are there two pyrotechnic igniters in there that ignite those fuel-rich gases coming out of the GG?
Let me get an F1 man in here.
Oh, okay. What's your name again now?
Tom Lewis.
Tom Lewis, okay. And I was curious about the that thrust chamber extension skirt on the F1. Are there two pyrotechnic igniters in there that ignite the fuel-rich GG exhaust as it comes through there? I came across that in one of the Saturn V news reference,
mm-hmm.
and I'm having trouble running that down.
You got a?
I feel sure it is.
I do too.
But
you know, it makes some modifications. Let me get.
When you say pyrotechnic,
I'm sure there was an igniter.
Okay, maybe it's just a variation of the ASI on the J2 then. Something like that. But there are igniters of some kind.
I think there is an igniter unless they have...
And they would be continuous. A pyrotechnic would just be a one-shot operation.
Right, okay. That helps explain my confusion there.
I don't know. Well, wait a minute. It's AA right here.
Okay.
Is that in the skirt? Extension skirt?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Igniter type TYP. That helps a lot.
Typical.
Which would be just a spark plug type.
Right.
Okay, but it's a continuous igniter
mm-hmm.
kind of thing, yeah. Okay, there's some other things I'm curious about. We were out at Rocketdyne this time. Went out and talked to Fuller and Bob Fontaine and Adinello and several of these people,
mm-hmm.
even McNamara.
Oh?
Yeah, oh, gee, we got right in there.
That was down in Seal Beach, though.
Yeah, we went down to see him down there. There are a few people, of course, that have changed around. But I was trying to establish some historical baselines for the brazing furnace technique. Now, were brazing furnaces in use before they started that big F1 operation? Or did they have to braze, say, the H1 and J2 engines by hand? Or do you know anything about those operations?
The H1 was hand brazed up to a point.
Mm-hmm.
Then they went to the furnace braze.
Yeah.
Was that at Neosho?
It was started at Canoga Park, moved to Neosho, and ended there.
Then they brought it back to Canoga Park.
I'm not sure
brazing.
They brought the furnace back or not.
Yeah.
They completed the production of the H1 at Neosho. Now, where the tooling is now, I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's not at Neosho. It may be in scrap.
I got a hunch that's completely closed down now. Yeah.
Yes, it's no longer in operation. Neosho has been out of business a couple of years.
Well. Were furnace brazing operations used for other engines like the RL-10 very early on and the S3V, or was the F1 the first to use that kind of stuff?
I can't answer that.
Can't
answer. But let's see who could give him an answer. Gene Cataldo.
Yeah.
I could pick up the phone and get it.
Well, I can call him, sometime. I was wondering if you could make some comments about the phasing out of static firing tests as you got into flight tests, on the various vehicles. How useful were the static tests as you went into the flight test? Should they have been phased out earlier, do you think, or what's your reaction to that?
You're speaking of static testing the stage?
Yeah,
or
okay.
The engine as a...
Static testing the stage then, yeah.
Well, that's political.
You can get all kinds of arguments, as long
yeah.
as you ask.
Yeah.
You won't get a decent answer to that question. You'll get an answer every time you try, but it won't be the same one.
It'll be
okay.
The individual's personal opinion that you're talking to at the time.
Yeah, okay, that kind of answers my question.
We static fired all of the S2s. We quit at number 10 on the S4B.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the rationale behind that, unless it's single engine versus multiple
cluster, yeah.
Cluster.
Well, what the one problem that you have on a lot of your first aids is a lot of those engines have been in storage for a good length of time before they're ready to be, you know, launched.
Yeah.
So there's always that question, you know, should we or shouldn't we?
Yeah.
Because they've been in storage, what, maybe some have been in 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I remember reading not too long ago in the Marshall Star, they pulled out an H1 and an F1 about a year apart, and it seemed to work okay. We had no problem with them. So
there has never been an engine requirement to static fire a stage. It's done strictly. See, we static fire the engine on its acceptance test at the plant. We make three runs on it.
Always.
Always.
Yeah.
Three minimum.
Yeah.
Well, on the F1, it could be two.
I'm talking J2. It differs for engines.
On the F1, it could be two, but we didn't have very many two because...
And we...
You had to go in and reorpus.
At that time, we were completely engine-oriented. Of course, we still are, but... We never had a requirement to static fire an engine on stage to prove that the engine could work. It's to prove that it was connected properly, if all the plumbing to it from the stage, and the stage systems. See, the stage systems never get exercised until in flight.
Until it goes, yeah.
But the engine enjoys a little bit better reliability testing than that. You can static fire it as many times as you want to, and it still can fly.
That brings up an interesting question about 501. What did you, how were you feeling the engine people when that thing went up and it was the first all-up flight? You hadn't gone through the sequential flight test, you know, with the engines and so on before.
You always have concern.
Yeah.
I still have concern. But 501 was the first restart test. There was always a little apprehension about your ability to restart an engine.
Yeah.
I'm speaking J2.
J2, yeah, the S4B stage.
Yeah. Now, it went fine. Of course, the next one didn't.
Yeah. Do you remember much about that ASI failure? I
sure do.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I can give you a report on it. It's in depth. If you just moved on.
I think the historical office probably had those, yeah.
Well, we had two engines that failed. ASI had ASI failures.
Yeah.
And there was a S4B. We knew about it when it would not restart. We had the stage had the, whenever an engine shuts down, certain time interval thereafter, the pre-valves close.
Right.
You know, the pre-valve, it
right.
separates the tank, the propeller from the engine.
Yeah.
So we wouldn't have known that we had an S2 failure had it not been wired wrong, and the signal, this time delay signal to close its own pre-valve, went to another engine.
Yeah.
And then for the temperature gradient, we knew we had similar type failures. And the failure was caused by, we had a flexible hose within a braid.
Mm-hmm.
All the testing that had been done at sea level. And at sea level, your hydrogen forms liquid air, hydrogen, and the liquid air in this tube dampened the flow vibration.
Mm-hmm.
At altitude, you don't have liquid air. And for that reason, it failed.
Yeah, and they finally had to set up some sort of test cell to purge the whole atmosphere to get that vacuum.
Well, the moment we started vacuum testing, the flex lines, they started going within seconds. So, I don't know how much further you want to go into this.
Well, how come they didn't try the vacuum test before on that line?
Because nobody thought about it.
Yes, okay.
I mean, you don't think that a vacuum can have anything to do with an inanimate body. And nobody realized or ever thought that the liquid air within the line was dampening. We didn't even know it had flow vibrations, but we didn't know that it was dampening. And it was a junior engineer that walks up and says, you aren't testing that line like it sees at altitude, and if they hadn't been desperate, they'd told him go on, he was alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then they decided, well, it may be something good.
You remember that guy's name by any chance?
No. And I would request that you I would request you didn't incorporate this in the history.
You would.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Because it may reflect on Rocketdyne Senior Engineering.
Yeah.
And that's the only reason. It's a nice story, but
what about it? Would you mind if I just put it in there, not for attribution or privileged source?
I'd prefer you wouldn't use it.
Okay, we'll just leave it out there. Let's see, I got some more items here. I'm a little bit vague on how engines were upgraded. I know they went up on the H1 in particular.
And the
J2. And the J2, yeah. And I heard one story about the J2 that it was always more or less a 230K engine.
Well, there's the way people talk about engines, they should, it's either a 200K engine or a 205K engine, or it's a 225 and a 230.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you'll hear people say a 200K engine and a 230K engine, which gives you a 30K
right.
differential
yeah.
as opposed to 5. If you, the engine at first was calibrated at the 5.0 mixture ratio,
right.
which is nominal,
yeah.
which is 200K. All right, that engine, that 200K engine, if you went to the 5.5 mixture ratio, would give you roughly 225K.
All right.
Now then, when we went to the 230K engine, we calibrated at 5.5 rather than 5.0. So that's how the, but you should always compare the thrust ratings at the same mixture ratio level and
yeah.
not take one at one end and one at the other end and then compare them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, that helps clear that up a little bit too. Then. And you get a better specific impulse out of it.
You get a better specific impulse at nominal
yeah.
than you do at 5.5
right.
where you're getting more thrust. Thrust and specific impulse are indirectly proportional.
Well, what about the upgrading end of the H1? I don't know.
Do you know how they
how they went into that? But the F1 was never upgraded.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Didn't it go? Well, 1522.
Mm-hmm.
But do you call 22K
out of
a million and a half? No. What did they do to get that extra 22?
Well, when they didn't really get an extra 22. Whenever the engine was designed for 1.5 million, you've got all kinds of pad in there. I mean,
yeah.
you can take an engine and set it up for 1.5 million pounds of thrust, what you think was 1.5 million. And it may come in 1,575,000.
Right.
All they did to get the 1522 was orifice the engine so that it would come in a nominal 1522 because that's what the stage needed.
So I just changed the orifices?
Yeah.
Okay.
There was no design.
And the gas generator, you change your orifice, and you can vary the thrust considerably.
Yeah.
See, for example, on the F1, in the early parts, in the early engines, they had a DG injector that the lower flow rates was marginal in stability.
Yeah.
Okay. So they had a requirement that the total flow, the GG had to be 170 pounds a second.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was the first thing they looked for. Make sure you have 170 pounds a second. But if you got below that, then you got into this marginal area of GG stability. Now, later on in the program, they went to a modified GG injector, the X4. And then they no longer had this 170 pound per second flow rate requirement because the X4 injector inherently was more stable. But the 1522 just came about because that was a nice number that the stage needed. If you had five engines with 1522, you know, average thrust, that met the requirements. Now, I would say if they needed 1550, they could have given them 1550.
Okay, but when you start to upgrade then, do you start with the gas generator first, or do you start orificing the injector stage?
Oh.
Or the combination?
Just GG.
Just
the injector.
The gas generator determines the power that your propeller pumps is going to get.
Yeah.
And
higher flow, the more
higher flow,
the faster your pump turns.
As long as we're on the F1 here a little bit, do you remember anything about the origins of that fifth engine on the Saturn V? There were some early design studies for only a four-engine vehicle and so on. The question came, you know, what they're going to do with the empty space. Do you hear anything about that?
That'd be a stage vehicle.
Yeah, okay.
I imagine they needed a thrust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For payload.
As I recall, probably the thrust, and also as long as that space is there, let's put something in there to improve the base heating and the
flow characteristics.
Yeah. Exactly.
That was before my time.
Yeah. Do you remember anything about the pogo problem on the F1? Combustion instability? You ran into about 62. Were you involved in any of that?
No. Unfortunately, about 62, that's the time that I was in Houston. Now,
come in. Look, Jack, not over this way.
The only real problem they had on the engine while I was working on it was they lost the LOX box. And this was only on the test stand. And they never had, of course, never had a failure on an engine, on the stage.
Yeah.
But found out that the LOX pumps, they were the cause of the problem. They were getting bubbles in the lines because the lines weren't insulated well enough. And they didn't have any high point leads to lead these gas out.
Is this Edwards?
They lost some at Edwards and they lost some at what they call an area down in Canoga where the green run pumps, CTL.
The compound test lift.
Yeah.
When you ask questions that we can't answer, I can give you names of people who can't answer, such as combustion instability on the F1.
Well, I talked to him already,
okay.
Jerry Thompson, yeah. I talked to him on that. And I also talked to Bob Pease, too, on the J2.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, and his name, Dick Rogers?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talked to him, too.
Okay.
So we got a lot of that actually pretty well covered. And some of the material that we've been reading, that lots of times the author begins with a statement, something to the fact that the engine is the longest lead time article.
Yeah.
And they'll start an engine without any particular idea for it.
Without an application.
Without an application,
right.
Exactly. Could you go into that a little bit for me? I mean, why, or the matrix of this thing?
I guess that we knew what kind of engine we wanted, roughly the thrust range, but the stage wasn't designed as yet.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm talking before my time. For instance, right now, the shuttle engine contract was let a year ago, and the stage hasn't been let yet.
Yeah, that's right.
Engine inherently is a long lead item.
It's
a
hard
time.
It's harder to develop than a stage.
Yeah.
See, a stage is, and if you're talking to stage people, they'll, they won't agree.
Okay. Yeah.
But if you compare an engine to a stage is basically non-movable items.
Yeah.
Tanks, piping, valving,
plumbing,
wiring, that kind of stuff. Whereas in all your engines, you got rotating machinery, and that's always a source of problems. Plus, you've got your combustion stability problems, which is always a problem.
Yeah,
it's true in aircraft, jet engines.
Okay, that brings me up to another thing here. I had a note I picked up somewhere about turbine blades made by Haynes Stellite. I've forgotten now, according to the note, if there was a problem with them or whether they were evolved out of some military program. Does that ring a bell with you, the Haynes Stellite turbine blades?
Yes, they were manufacturing blades, and they got some batches made of wrong material.
That's the one. That was on the F1, was it?
H1.
H1, yeah. And there was a big flap then about quality control with the vendors and sub-vendors.
Yeah, there was. I was trying to think if we ever had a failure. I guess we did.
Yes.
Maybe
yes.
Some cracks.
Yes,
yes.
We had
some turbine failures on the H1.
Had turbine failures, and then when they started investigating the material, they found it to be improper.
Oh, now I remember what my question was on this. That same stuff they were using on the, didn't the Atlas have similar engines with Haynes Stellite blades. Do you know what happened with those? Did they have to go back and refit the Atlas? This is back in 66.
I don't know if Atlas was involved or not.
Yeah.
T.P. will know. T.P. Smith or Jim Sloan, as soon as they get back.
Yeah. All right, now I remember why I asked that, because I remember they're talking about going back and retrofitting the H-1s, and it occurred to me I wonder if they had to do the same thing in some of the military engines as well.
I'm sure that on cases like this, we put out what we call an alert to all space and aircraft industry. Here's a situation that happened to us. Be aware that this situation.
Check your own housekeeping.
Yeah.
If you got any of these.
And DOD, they do the same to us. If they find some fluke, we put out an alert on this flex hose.
The ASI thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because this was beyond the state of the art thinking.
Yeah.
And it bit us, so you don't want your other government agencies to be bit in our industry.
Yeah. There's a lot of these questions, I admit, are kind of picky, but we're getting towards the end of this thing. There are a lot of things coming up. We're trying to chase them down a little bit. At the beginning of the S-4 stage, they're talking about Pratt & Whitney engines. And I really am sorry, I can't remember the sequence. I think they were going to use what was known as the RL-115, and they ran into problems and went to the RL-119. Do you remember anything about that, what the difficulties were?
I didn't even know there was a 115 and 119.
Yeah, well, it finally came out the RL-10A3, but
the 119, engine. I thought that was their...
their competitive engine?
Their high PC engine.
I did too. But I thought he was talking about...
XL-119.
Yeah. Was the
maybe that was it.
Competitive engine with the
shuttle. Was their high PC engine?
No, it would be a different one because this is back in the early 60s when they were talking about the S-4 stage where I came across.
Okay, their original engine was an RL-10. I worked on that for 4 years.
The RL-10 at Pratt & Whitney?
Mm-hmm.
How would you compare it? Well, you worked on the F-1 then. I was going to ask you, how would you compare it to, say, the J-2 as an engine system?
It's kind of hard to compare. You're talking about 200K versus 15K.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like comparing apples and oranges. And of course, I don't know. I haven't worked on the J-2 that much, but basically they're the same engines. Some one's bigger, right, Tim?
Well, there's a bootstrap cycle on the RL-10 that makes it a lot different.
Well, there's a bootstrap cycle on the J-2. Maybe not the same bootstrap.
Yeah, it's a little, different arrangement somehow.
I don't know anything about the RL-10.
The RL-10 has some, the later versions have some nice, where you can throttle.
Throttleable.
Any percent of full rated thrust you want.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah.
Did it have a ECA, or was it a pressure ladder?
Pressure ladder, I think.
I would say, I'm talking about knowledge, but I'd say that the J-2 is more complicated. I think the RL-10 would be a simpler engine.
Mm-hmm. Where you look at it.
Look at that beast over there, all the plumbing on it.
Yeah.
RL-10 only weighs something like 300 pounds.
Of course, the J-2 was going into a restart capability.
Yes, this has a restart capability, which really complicates it.
Yeah. And it's a higher altitude, 100 nautical mile altitude or something like that, too.
Well, it starts at 200 miles. Up.
That's it, yeah.
It has to start at altitude. I don't know what the RL-10 started at altitude ever. Was it?
No, I don't think it ever restarted.
No.
It was an altitude engine.
To begin with, yeah.
You mean it would start at altitude?
Yes.
Okay. Well.
It was an upper state engine.
Yeah.
See, their acceptance testing was in a
vacuum. Okay, not familiar with
that. That was one of the big problems they had. You know, first, they did all their development testing kind of sea level, you know. And, not really. They had a steam ejector, on
mm-hmm.
the diffuser. But they ran them all at horizontal, and they ran them in single positions. And then the first time they ran two engines simultaneously in a vertical position, that's when they ran into their first major problem.
Caved in the thrust chambers.
One engine lit and the other one didn't.
Yeah.
And it dumped all that LOX in there. And then it lit, and there was pieces flying every direction for as far as you could see.
Can you go in? You were down there working on it this time, is that right?
Yeah.
Could you explain that again for me? What the difference was between the horizontal and vertical testing, and what the problems were?
I don't really know what the problem was. The All I know about that problem is that all the development engines up to that point had been done in a horizontal position.
But only single?
Single engine only.
Mm-hmm.
And then they ran in a vertical position, which was a two ejector type thing.
Would have been Centaur.
Right. Yeah. And the first test that they ran in that attitude was, you know, two engines, and one engine lit, and the second engine did not light.
And it continued to dump its propellant.
But it's still got this
right
mid trap, see, and it's dumping its propellant right down into the ejector. And it got, the discharge got lighted from the other engine that was burning. And then it caused.
Well, you don't know that horizontal versus vertical had anything to do with it?
No. The only, right offhand, the only reason I'd say it made any difference is that, you know, it just had the igniter was just a spark plug up in the injector. Now, you know, when you start feeding this thing in a vertical position, do you get this injection so good beyond the ignition point?
As I recall now, I think that Jerry Thompson and I talked about this, and he got into it for some reason in more detail. I think I got that. He made some comment about that. But there's another thing, though, that I'm a little bit vague about, is that there are all these test facilities at Canoga Park and Edwards and so on, and yet there were parallel testing going on here at Marshall.
Right.
And to a layman, it just looked like too much redundancy, and yet there was a strong feeling, obviously, that was necessary. Could you go and talk about that a little bit? The rationale for it, and what you learned, particularly here at Marshall, and how it fed back into the contractor.
I had rather let someone else answer that question.
Well, for one thing, it's not going to answer your question, but it'll answer part of your question. Is Rocketdyne doesn't have any facilities for cluster testing.
They're all single engine stands up there. And Edwards had the cluster test stuff.
No. Marshall had cluster test.
Oh, okay. I'd forgotten that. All right. Yeah. And then they did it at MTS.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
You see, yeah. Rocketdyne doesn't have any facilities for cluster testing.
Well, they began F1 testing, as I recall my note here. They began single-engine F1 tests here at Marshall ahead of Rocketdyne.
There has always been a tendency for Marshall to do a lot in-house. They have been losing this over the years.
Yeah.
And it's contracted out. You aren't the first one that's asked that question.
Yeah.
Some people closer to home.
Okay, I was wondering if you could make some comments going back to some of the early design studies and so on, the reasons for using, say, liquid engines over solid propulsion engines that facilitated gimballing, start and shut down sequences and an engine out arrangement. Better adapted for manned flight ratings, or whether this is a specific impulse barrier, at least the one that existed, say, 7 or 8 years ago.
Well, you can get all kinds of arguments on liquid versus solid.
That's another.
No one has questions.
Another question.
Of course, it does facilitate gimbling.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. very hard to gimbal a solid engine.
Yeah.
You have reaction control.
Which is tough.
Yeah.
It's much more complicated. Man rating, I would think, soon would probably be one of the big factors. Because you can fire a liquid engine, you know, essentially as many times as you want to make sure that that's a good engine.
Right.
You can't fire a solid